Welcome to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Liechtenstein and Mauritania. One is a tiny German-speaking country tucked high into the Swiss Alps. It's a favorite jurisdiction for high finance, thanks to low taxes and offshore financial services. The other is a Muslim-majority nation on Africa's west coast, identified by the CIA as a source of human trafficking. Between the two sits Cuba. Not geographically, of course, but in terms of the official business conducted between the United States and those countries. The U.S. may have a trade embargo with Cuba for the past 50-plus years, but we still do official business with the communist island. It ranks 136th on the list of countries trading with America. About $260 million worth of American goods were bought by Cuba through the first 10 months of last year. It's mostly food like fresh and frozen chicken, soybeans, and corn, along with medical supplies, stuff like hearing aids and crutches. According to the official trade statistics, exactly $0 worth of Cuba goods were bought in America. Now, trade was never mentioned when President Obama announced the historic changes to the U.S. policy toward Cuba 3 weeks ago, at least not by name. But among the intents of the policy changes is increased business between the U.S. and Cuba, especially the growing number of small private enterprises there.
I believe that American businesses should not be put at a disadvantage, and that increased commerce is good for Americans and for Cubans. So we will facilitate authorized transactions between the United States and Cuba. U.S. financial institutions will be allowed to open accounts at Cuban financial institutions, and it will be easier for U.S. exporters to sell goods in Cuba.
If these changes come to be, what could be in store for South Florida's economy? How do the particular politics of our region, with its history of strong opposition to official business between the U.S. and Cuba while the Castro regime remains in power, shape the response? Will the Sunshine Economy do business with Cuba?
There are no assurances when doing business with a country that has a history of 55 years of nationalization of private property. Ariana Mendez, Miami, Florida.
My name is Mara Houston. I live in Miami-Dade County. I will not do business with Cuban entrepreneurs while the present government is still in power.
Mara Houston and Ariana Mendez are members of the WLRN Miami Herald Public Insight Network. They echo the thoughts of many Cuban Americans in South Florida. Just days after President Obama announced the changes, WLRN's Tim Padgett spoke with Esperanza Garcia of Hialeah at a protest in Little Havana.
I consider it a great betrayal, Garcia said. She added, this will benefit the Castro's pockets, not the Cuban people.
The survey that was conducted immediately following the president's statement found Cuban Americans in South Florida split, though. 48% disagreeing with the president's strategy, 44% supporting. The poll was conducted by the Bendixson Amandi International Firm for the Miami Herald, El Nuevo Herald, and Tampa Bay Times.
I knew we were going to have to be prepared to be very busy because for 20 years we've been saying this is going to happen and what do we do when it happens?
That's Thomas Hertzfeld. He runs an investment advisory firm based in Miami Beach that bears his name. He helps run a publicly traded investment fund focused on companies doing business in the Caribbean, including Cuba. In fact, the four-letter trading symbol of the fund on the NASDAQ stock exchange is C-U-B-A. Brigitte Hertzfeld is the managing director of her father's firm.
We were really excited. I mean, this is just a big step. I mean, mostly for the Cuban people, just to see this change. We're from Miami, so it really affects us at heart. You know, the Cuban culture is a big part of our lives in Miami. So we were really emotional about it.
The thawing of relations with Cuba after a half century is emotional. The families torn apart, fathers, uncles, brothers killed. Moms, aunts, grandmothers not seen. Countless stories of struggle and survival. The hostility between the United States and Cuba may be over political philosophies, but it's waged with economics, and the rules are about to change. Tomas Regalado is the mayor of the city of Miami. He was born in Havana. His father was an attorney and journalist who was a political prisoner for 22 years in Cuba. Mayor Regalado, welcome to the Sunshine Economy. Nice to see you. Happy New Year.
Good morning.
Is the loosening of travel and some of these exporting restrictions that are on the table now, is that good for South Florida?
I don't think so, for several reasons. And number one, people are going to Cuba anyways, and people are taking things to relatives in Cuba. The fact that the remittance have been extended, it would only draw money from the local economy. And so I don't see an immediate good thing for the economy in South Florida, other than several more million dollars will be taken out of the economy in terms of remittances to the family, which I agree. I mean, if you want to help your family, that's your prerogative. People work two shifts here in order to support the families in Cuba. The other problem that I see is that companies are very excited here, but laws need to be changed. In Cuba, for instance, there is a law that says that any foreign investor can only have 49% of the stocks in a Cuban business, mm-hmm. and the Cuban government have 51%. In the last 2 years, we have seen like 10 business from Spain to leave the country because of that situation. They do not control the people that they hire. They do not control the things that they can buy. So it would be very, very long. You know, you just had a report about Cuba buying in the U.S., the Helms-Burton law and the Torricelli law, they all have loopholes. So there is no embargo. Cuba can buy whatever they want if they pay cash. If Cuba is seeking loans, then, well, you know.
There's official trade with Cuba, which is really focused on agriculture, food, and medicine. There's the unofficial, the black market or the gray market trade that we know that happens between Hialeah and Havana and other places in South Florida and Cuba. I want to tackle your concern about remittances. What the president has proposed is to increase remittances up to $2,000 per quarter. Your concern is that could sap consumer spending here in South Florida because it would draw the dollars outside of Florida into Havana.
Absolutely. And I, you know, if you go by one of those places that send goods to Cuba in Monday morning, today, mm-hmm. You can see a line of people trying to get their families some money and some goods to Cuba. So that would increase. That would siphon money from the economy here in South Florida. Would it create jobs? I don't think so.
Well, the president also wants to increase the types of exports that Americans can send to Cuba legally, legitimately. Doesn't that hold the potential, perhaps, of spurring on some economic activity here in South Florida, given the geography of this place?
You know, the way that Cuba functions, they can get anything. Excuse me. They can get anything that they want. Mm-hmm. They can send it through Panama. They do it through Jamaica. They send tires. They send engines for cars. You know, you can do everything because the so-called embargo is very flexible in terms of third countries.
Should South Florida and South Floridians seek to do business legally in Cuba, given the policy changes that are likely to happen this year?
I mean, there is a moral issue and a money issue.
Right.
If they want to risk it, well, look what happened to
risk
the company.
Risk the moral issue?
Risk the money. But the moral issue, I think it's important. The Congress of the United States just passed a law, and the president signed sanctions against Venezuela for human rights violations. And yet, Cuba just beat up several dissidents and arrested an actress that just wanted to say whatever she wanted to say in a public forum. So I think that the United States, who has been in the forefront of defending human rights, is neglecting the position that we as a leader have in the world. And more dangerous than that, this morning, Mr. Maduro, the president of Venezuela, said that he will be willing to free the leading opposition person in Venezuela if the United States free Puerto Rican terrorist in U.S. Jail. So it is an irony that the United States, who has a policy of not negotiating with countries that sponsor terrorism, still Cuba is in the list of countries that sponsor terrorism. We just handed people that were responsible for the killing of U.S. citizens in the U.S.
It was a prisoner swap that led to the easing of some of these financial and economic restrictions. We're speaking with Tomas Regalado, mayor of the city of Miami. How much input, if any, did you have in the White House announcement back in December?
None. I mean, they had the courtesy of calling me about an hour before the president was going to make the announcement.
So no earlier designation that these plans or these negotiations
just an
have
hour,
been happening.
And you know, it was funny because the
had
person,
you been led to believe you would be consulted prior to any kind of announcement?
Yes. Yes, because, you know, when we had issues like the earthquake in Haiti and situations in Cuba, Homeland Security does call us and consult with us.
I want to ask you, the day of the announcement, you came out against the idea of having a Cuban consulate in Miami. Do you still are in opposition of that? Should that be on the drawing board in 2015 or years in the future?
And this is not an emotional issue. This is just about the safety and peace of the community and budget issues. You know, when the Venezuelan consulate was functioning in Brickell, every week there was a rally of Venezuelans in front of the consulate. And then the City of Miami Police Department had to send several units for hours and even a day to protect the diplomats and the protester and to do traffic. And who pay for that bill? Not the State Department, not the Venezuelan government, the residents of the City of Miami.
If the majority of Cuban Americans in Miami-Dade County, or almost a majority of Americans in Miami-Dade County, think that the trade embargo has not worked and would like to see a consulate here, if Tampa, for instance, is in the running for a consulate, would Miami be losing out on the opportunities to make the relationships, financial and familial relationships between South Florida and Havana, more efficient by having a consulate here?
I don't think that we'll be losing anything because, number one, the Cubans here in South Florida who wants to travel to Cuba, they figured out the way to do it anyways. And a consulate here will create tensions in the community. It would harm the safety and the peace of the community. It would put a burden and an unfunded mandate from Washington in the City of Miami. And I don't think that we want TV cameras live every day in anywhere in the City of Miami showing protests and people engaging in discussions and maybe fistfight or something like that.
Mayor Tomas Regalado, mayor of the City of Miami. We've got more to come here on the Sunshine Economy on WLRN, following the money, the bankers between Florida and Cuba. Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy, Opportunity or Entrenchment, America's Changing Cuban Policy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. When President Obama appeared in the White House cabinet room just after noon Eastern time on December 17th, he announced changes to the national policy regarding Cuba, but he spoke to one particular city, Miami.
Today, Miami is often referred to as the capital of Latin America, but it is also a profoundly American city, a place that reminds us that ideals matter more than the color of our skin or the circumstances of our birth, a demonstration of what the Cuban people can achieve, and the openness of the United States to our family to the south.
The American effort to normalize relations between Havana and Washington further loosens U.S. restrictions on travel and money family members can send to Cuba. It also allows U.S. banks to open correspondent accounts in Cuba. These types of accounts would conceivably reduce barriers to doing business between the United States and Cuba. Juan Del Busto is the former regional executive of the Miami branch of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. He joins us. David Schwartz is the president and CEO of the Florida International Bankers Association. And Alex Sanchez on the telephone. He's the president and CEO of the Florida Bankers Association with us from Tallahassee. Welcome to the trio of bankers here. Juan, what will U.S. banks be dealing with in Cuba?
Well, establishing correspondent accounts with Cuba would be a tremendous burden on the banks here.
How so?
Because what happened in the past, all the banks had correspondence accounts. All of a sudden, those accounts were frozen, and those dollars remained in Cuba.
This is back in the 30s and 40s and early 50s.
Back in the 50s, late 50s and early 60s when Castro took over. So for a financial institution to establish a correspondent account there, what if 2 years down the road, tensions again suffer? What happens to those dollars?
Alex Sanchez with the Florida Bankers Association. What's the role of the correspondent account, and what's the corresponding financial institution in Cuba that a U.S. bank would do business with?
Well, good morning, Tom, and my colleagues, Juan and David. Let me just say this. I mean, this is obviously, you know, debate is good. So it's always good to debate issues. Now, we've got some moral and human rights issues we got to deal with. I'm going to raise some legal concerns with you. But before I do that, let me say this. On the day before the president's announcement, the Cuban Ghost Guard fired on another rickety boat of 32 Cubans trying to leave that island. Mm-hmm. And many of those people were killed. And back in July of 13, 1994, there were 70 people trying to leave, and Cuban MiG jets and the Coast Guard fired on these people. What kind of country does that to people trying to leave the country? Now, human rights advocacy has always been important to the United States. Last year, Cuba had almost 3 million tourists, but there was no change. Just Europeans with iPhones filming how dissidents are beat up on the streets of Havana. So now you have the president's announcements, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
You have Raul's daughter the day after the president's announcement saying nothing is going to change in Cuba. I'm setting the table to get to the banking issue. There is no embargo with Cuba. Cuba can buy any product worldwide.
That's exactly echoing what the mayor of Miami, in fact, told us just earlier, Alex. But what about from your members, Florida bankers,
yes,
if they do seek to do business, with whom would they do business in Cuba?
Exactly. I appreciate the president's words. I mean, I respect the president. But for us to open up correspondent banking accounts with this backdrop of a tyranny that I just gave you in 30 seconds, our banking federal regulators have problems in Miami with citizens that we bank because of the OFAC list that we have to compare them to,
mm-hmm,
because of the Bank Secrecy Act legislation that was passed in Washington. How in God's name are we going to bank anyone in Cuba and still pass muster with the federal banking regulators?
Juan, you used to be a banking regulator with the Federal Reserve.
Alex, I agree with you 100%. I'm not in agreement from a political standpoint, but from a regulatory standpoint, the same thing. Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, and of course, I'm retired from there, but speaking in the past, has responsibility for Cuba. We had a branch in Cuba. So, like I told Tom and my colleagues here, the devil is in the details. We don't have any of those details.
So David Schwartz with the Florida International Bankers Association, what is the banking infrastructure that the bankers would be encountering in Cuba should this policy that the president announced in December go forth?
Well, actually, at this point in time, Tom, they wouldn't encounter any true infrastructure, which would be a huge barrier to doing any type of business or opening any type of correspondent account. But as Alex and Juan have mentioned, the biggest problem here locally for the banks is the regulatory side. What we've seen in the last few years are banks doing what's been termed de-risking. And part of that de-risking is eliminating high-risk types of activities and accounts on their balance sheet.
Banks here in South Florida don't want to do business that could look like doing business with Cuba.
That is correct.
Which is not an incentive to do new business with Cuba.
That is absolutely correct. I've been receiving calls not just from bank members but from actual corporations asking me, I'm having my accounts closed at banks here in South Florida. Where can I get an account open? Because I am doing legitimate business with Cuba. I am a licensed travel service business, yet my bank refuses to do business with me.
Alex Sanchez with the Florida Bankers Association. Let me ask you, I mean, as important as family remittances are, as important as travel is, this banking component of the policy change is the grease. It is the economics if it is able to find some way, some workable solution here. But critics abound.
Well, Tommy, here's the point. Forget the politics. I mean, you know, that I personally am against, you know, dealing with the Castro regime, their instability and their tyranny. And you don't know one day to another what's going to happen. Let's get to the legal issues. There's no respect of due process in Cuba. There's no respect of private property. So as Juan said, if we open up these accounts, you know, the Castro regime wakes up the next morning saying, you know what, I'm tired, or they do something internationally that our country doesn't like, and all of a sudden the relationships go south. What happens then? So in addition to what I said about the federal banking regulators, and I know a bank, a U.S. chartered bank that is owned by a wealthy person from South America, their correspondent bank account had to be closed by another domestic bank, and this owner of this bank shows up on the Fortune 500 list,
yeah,
and he's a credible, legitimate person in this world.
All
and
three yet, of you here, we're short on time, Alex. Apologies for the interruption. But,
yeah,
but Juan, how important is this banking component to the overall policy change?
I think they're doing business with banks all over the world now.
Cuba is.
So if there's not a U.S. correspondent bank, they'll go through other channels, like when we send cash out of the Fed legally to other countries,
sure,
it ends up in other people's
they
hands.
They can do
so
business with Spanish banks, Canadian banks, all of those.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But for American banks here, David Schwartz with the Florida International Bankers Association, how important is this financial component to the policy?
Well, it's not going to bring any great change because, as Juan was saying,
on the island,
the global banks, yeah, are already doing business in Cuba. As long as those transactions do not touch the United States, they will continue to do that because they won't have an issue with the violation of sanctions.
And Alex Sanchez with the Florida Bankers Association, your guidance to your members is stay away?
Well, you know, Tom, you know, until there's substantial change in Cuba, I don't know how you can deal, not just Cuba, or North Korea, any country that doesn't respect due process and private property, you don't know what you're dealing with day to day. So how can you invest in a country to do business? I don't know how it's possible and how you can take that risk.
Alex Sanchez with the Florida Bankers Association, David Schwartz with the Florida International Bankers Association, and Juan Del Busto, former regional executive with the Miami branch of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. The bankers following the money with the U.S.-Cuba policy changes. Still to come, after investing around Cuba for 20 years,
I knew inside of my heart when I was in Boston getting this announcement that it was going to be a big deal. And, you know, 5 minutes later, the phone is ringing off the hook.
We're back on the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. It was 1994 when Brigitte Herzfeld came home from her private school in Coral Gables and told her dad he should do more business with Cuban Americans in Miami. Her dad, Thomas Herzfeld, ran his own successful investment advisory firm.
It just seemed like a natural fit. It wasn't even in my head a question. It just, we live in Miami with a huge Cuban community, and it's a vital part of the community, and the bulk of my friends were Cuban, so it just made sense to work with Cubans, and I thought they're very hardworking and honest people, and we had grown very close with them living in Miami, so it just seemed like a natural fit to do something with them. So the whole idea just came about. I mean, maybe a little premature because it was in 1994.
Her dad, Thomas Herzfeld, formed the Herzfeld Caribbean Basin Fund. Cuba, CUBA, is its ticker symbol on the NASDAQ stock exchange. It's what's called a closed-end fund. Now, if you're familiar with investment funds, it's probably mutual funds. A mutual fund is considered an open-end fund. There are no limits on the number of shares a mutual fund can issue. The fund usually owns stocks in dozens, sometimes hundreds of different companies. The share price of a mutual fund is determined by the share prices of the stocks inside the fund and the number of shares the mutual fund itself has. Now, a closed-end fund has a fixed number of shares that trade on a stock exchange, a closed number of shares. The daily prices do not necessarily reflect the sum of the individual stocks held by the fund itself, but rather the buyers and sellers of the closed-end fund shares.
That means the price of a closed-end fund can be more or less than the total of the stocks held in the fund. If a closed-end fund price is below its total price, then it's said to be traded at a discount. If the fund's share price is above the total value of the stocks in the fund, then it's said to be trading at a premium. For about 4 years, the Hertzfeld Caribbean Basin Fund traded at a discount. Then December 17th's announcement came of the effort toward normalizing relations between the U.S. and Cuba. The fund has traded at a premium since then. We spoke with Thomas Hertzfeld and his daughter, Brigida Hertzfeld, at their Miami Beach offices about the day of that announcement and now what for the investment fund.
To be honest, I was in the car with both of my kids in their car seats, and they were screaming at the top of their lungs, and President Obama was about to come on, and I was trying to get them to be quiet. And I knew that my father was scheduled to speak on CNBC right after, so I really wanted to listen to what he had to say, but the kids were screaming at the top of their lungs, and I had to pull over and entertain them with lollipops to listen to what my father had to say. Of course, you know, it's because I was not in the Miami office at that time when the announcement happened. But it was so there was just a lot of things going on. But I mean, at the root of it, it was just a very exciting moment for us.
Was there a moment when it sunk in, or, you know, the dimensions of what was being announced that you were able to internalize as an investment professional with one who's putting clients' assets at risk, but in addition to somebody who has lived and breathed the Cuban-American experience as somebody who's not Cuban-American but born and raised in Miami?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. I think because we're from Miami, we knew exactly how heavy and important this decision and this announcement was going to be. I think when I have lived up north in the past, I think it's harder for the community in Boston to understand how big of a role Cuba plays in the lives of the people in Miami, and to the larger extent, what it will play in the future for all Florida and the U.S. So I think I knew inside of my heart when I was in Boston getting this announcement that it was going to be a big deal. And, you know, 5 minutes later, the phone is ringing off the hook.
I just finished jogging up South Beach, and I was coming home to take a shower and have a cup of coffee with my wife, Ruli, and my son, Eric, who is co-portfolio manager of the firm, called me and said, President Obama is going to speak, and I think this is going to be related to Alan Gross.
And we certainly got that with the release of Gross, but as you realize the weight of the announcement gone quickly beyond a prisoner swap and had these economic consequences.
Well, I felt this is a historic event of enormous proportion, and that the consequences were going to be very significant.
The 20 years since you guys have had the fund, 1994 had another wave of bolseros. You've seen the steady but slow easing of travel restrictions. You've seen the passing of leadership from one Castro brother to the next. You've seen what arguably some would say is a slightly larger appetite for private enterprise within Cuba. You've seen continued reliance of Cuba on Venezuela and the petrodollars that its economy had traditionally been supplying Cuba up until the last few months. What gave you, Tom, the confidence to continue with the fund despite all of these global political pressures?
Actually, I continue with it because we were making a lot of money. we created a strategy of investing in companies throughout the Caribbean Basin, which we thought would do well even if there were no political or economic change in Cuba. But also we invested in companies which we thought would benefit greatly from resumption of trade with the country.
Well, also from a geopolitical standpoint, we knew that change was imminent in Cuba. I mean, if you look at Vietnam in 86, 87, when they started having talks to change the economic structure, and since then they became the largest exporter of cashews and the second largest exporter of rice. And a lot of this was made possible because they started having these talks to normalize relations with other countries, and their GDP skyrocketed after that. And so we sort of had our eye on Cuba as the next hopeful opening up, the next market to hopefully open up. And we knew change was going to happen. We just did not know when or how. But, you know, it's the modernization of times. Like, we knew something was going to happen.
Was it difficult to hold steady to that vision based in South Florida, steeped in the hardline anti-Castro support for the trade embargo and non-engagement, no diplomatic relations with Cuba?
Mm-hmm. Oh, over the 20 years, I was extremely sensitive to that. And I went out of my way, you know, not to even come close to violating the embargo, even in spirit. I was so cautious. And we didn't have to, you know, it was so easy, frankly, to pick stocks in the Caribbean, which would do well while we were waiting. So, we very much stayed away from anything sensitive regarding Cuba. But in recent years, I was listening to Senator Rubio speak about a week ago, and if you asked me 10 years ago how I felt about the embargo, everything he said I agreed with then, but now I've moderated my views, and I listened to President Obama saying, you know, if something hasn't worked in 50 years, why don't we try and change it? The younger generation of Cuban Americans, I've never heard any of them take the position that some of their parents did. I know some of my first directors were of the older generation of Cuban Americans, and they felt very strongly about having anything to do with the Castros, but their children didn't feel that strongly. I remember my father was a soldier in World War II. He would never drive a German car, but I drove a Porsche. You know, so I think the next generation removed feels differently.
Highlighting the geographic proximity to Cuba that we have here in Florida, we've been able to see it coming, and we can feel it, and we understand the culture really well, the Cuban culture. And I think that's going to be a key part of doing business in and around Cuba. Where we are standing, we are basically, they used to call, and they still do call, Miami North Havana. So we have that vantage point, and it's not just something you can learn overnight.
Brigida Hertzfeld and her father, Thomas Hertzfeld, who operate the Hertzfeld Caribbean Basin Fund out of Miami Beach. It invests in stocks of companies it believes benefit from the Caribbean economy, including Cuba. As of June, its biggest investments were Copa Airlines, based in Panama, Coca-Cola FEMSA, the Mexican-based maker and distributor of Coca-Cola there, pork, poultry, and cargo shipper Seaboard, and the Miami-based engineering and construction company Mastech. Still to come on our program, Made in Cuba. Could Cuba one day export health care?
With doctors making $28 a month, with the United States and including South Florida, having a longer-term shortage of medical personnel, especially primary care and especially nurses. The concept that a well-trained physician come up to Miami to become a registered nurse in the United States, including in South Florida.
This is the Sunshine Economy, Opportunity or Entrenchment, America's Changing Cuban Policy. I'm Tom Hudson. The changes announced by President Obama to the U.S. policy toward Cuba were not met with changes announced in Havana. When Cuban President Raul Castro spoke about the agreement in front of Cuba's National Assembly a few days after it was announced, he pledged not to change.
No debe pretenderse.
Castro said, "We can't pretend that by improving ties with the United States, Cuba will renounce the ideas for which it has fought, for which its people have shed a lot of blood and has run the biggest risks."
Por la que su pueblo ha derramado mucha sangre y ha corrido los mayores riesgos.
The lack of change within Cuba is what critics argue is the big failing of the U.S. changes. No requirement for better human rights, no mandate for more freedoms, no demand for a more open economy in exchange for the U.S. relaxing its restrictions on business Americans can do with Cuba. Supporters of normalization call that the biggest misunderstanding about the policy reform. They say it was not intended to change the island overnight, but rather put the United States in a more effective position to help democratize Cuba. Either way, any future economic relationship likely would be dominated by American exports to Cuba. American products and brands have officially been locked out of Cuba since the early 1960s. But what could Cuba offer America? Its biggest exports are refined petroleum like gasoline and sugar. Commodities dominate the business Cuba does with the world, but its fourth largest export product category last year was pharmaceutical products, such as mixtures for medicines. It highlights what could be a key Cuban export if economic ties are reestablished with the United States in the years ahead. In fact, there is already precedent. 15 years ago, U.S. pharmaceutical companies were allowed to import a Cuban-made meningitis vaccine during an epidemic in this country.
Cuba has a, if you will, almost an oversupply of physicians.
That's Stephen Ullman. He's director of programs in and Center for Health Sector Management and Policy at the University of Miami School of Business Administration. He's also co-author of the book, Cuban Healthcare, Utopian Dreams, Fragile Future.
As boundaries potentially open up, is the flow of medical resources, human resources in particular, in that with doctors making $28 a month, with the United States and having a, and including South Florida, having a longer-term shortage of medical personnel, especially primary care and especially nurses, the concept that a physician could come up to a well-trained physician come up to Miami and even go through a short course program, and there are short course programs available now that involve about a one-year training and transition process to become a registered nurse in the United States, including in South Florida. This could help toward alleviating part of the nursing shortage and perhaps part of the primary care shortage that we are going to be experiencing.
Cuba's medical industry has a carefully cultivated international reputation, especially the delivery of health care. Cuban doctors were among those in Africa last year treating Ebola patients, just one of the world hotspots they appear.
For example, the Cuban physicians were almost first on scene after the Haitian earthquake, and there was a lot of laudable efforts by them, and this draws a lot of public attention.
Critics say those types of high-profile international healthcare aid efforts are part humanitarian effort, part marketing strategy, with the goal of diverting attention away from the Cuban regime's dismal human rights record and the serious decay of its own healthcare infrastructure. According to the World Bank, in 2010, Cuba could boast the second highest rate of doctors for its population. It was second only to Qatar, and almost three times the rate in the United States. But having plenty of doctors has not ensured a stable and accessible healthcare system. Again, Stephen Ullman, who studies healthcare policy and management at the University of Miami.
Doctors and nurses serve their specific community. The community is served by a doctor and a nurse in a home and an office that is in that small community. You see that all through Cuba. That is the positive attribute in terms of structure. What has happened over time is because there's been so much deterioration of the infrastructure, and what you see in these clinics that are there is sterilization techniques are, for example, use of hot water, which is not a sterilization technique. You see reuse of needles. You see people having to bring their own bedding if they're going to stay in a facility. You see people having to try to find bandage materials, even simple medications like aspirin and antibiotics are in extremely short supply.
Yet for international visitors, the accessibility and quality of Cuban healthcare is a selling point. Medical tourism attracted an estimated 200,000 visitors to Cuba in recent years, according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It found a nose job in the United States cost $4,500, in Thailand, $2,500.
In Cuba, just over $1,500. A Cuban tummy tuck runs less than a third what it does in America.
And with the realization that there are 900,000 Americans who go overseas for their health care currently and usually go far greater distances for that health care, and the realization that Cuba has a culture and a language that is common to people here in the United States, for many people in the United States, that it's very likely that medical tourism will, as the country opens up, will move from the United States over to Cuba as an alternative to going further south in Latin America.
The medical tourism effort follows the same strategy Cuba has used to become an exporter of health care by sending their doctors, who are government employees, overseas to work in foreign and friendly countries. But those doctors make only $28 per month or so, according to Steve Ullman at the University of Miami, as he mentioned earlier. That low pay and high skill of Cuban physicians could both draw in business to the island and also push that labor out of the country where demand is higher and push Cuban patients out of the country as they look for more quality health care for themselves and their families.
Medical tourism is becoming an industry in and of itself. And so the concept of an outflow of patients to Cuba for some basic services as those services open up, but also if the economy starts improving in Cuba and you start having individuals who are perhaps more financially well off if the economy starts expanding, then what you also can see an inflow because medical tourism goes both ways. And because we have a very strong secondary and tertiary sector here in South Florida with some of the best specialty care available anywhere in the world, you can also see incoming healthcare population moving up in this area.
Stephen Ullman with the University of Miami, co-author of Cuban Healthcare, Utopian Dreams, Fragile Future. Still to come on our program, well before the exiles and the boat lifts, South Florida's economic ties to Cuba came through Key West.
If you went down the street, you could hear the radios going in people's houses. Nobody had air conditioning, so all the windows were open. You could hear, 100 pesos, you know, the bolita.
We're back on the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. As the United States looks toward a new relationship with Cuba, South Florida and Cuba have had a long history of politics, people, and the search for profits. As Nancy Klingener in our Florida Keys Bureau tells us, that history began in the state's southernmost city almost a century before Fidel Castro took power.
In the last few decades of the 19th century, thousands of Cuban exiles crossed the Florida Straits. They were looking for political freedom and economic opportunity.
Key West was the capital of the Cuban exile at the time. It was the Miami of the 1870s and the 1880s.
Rafael Peñalver is president of the San Carlos Institute in Key West. It was founded by Cuban exiles in 1871. The San Carlos was an idealistic community center, hosting cultural events and political meetings. Alejandro Pascual wrote a book about Key West then. He says 1868 is a key year. That's when the 10 Years' War, an uprising against Spain, began.
And many people thought their lives were in danger, so many people started seeking refuge outside of Cuba.
Cuban immigrants also came to Key West for jobs in the island's new cigar industry. Factory owners imported Cuban tobacco and paid cigar makers to roll them in Key West.
And that way they avoided the custom duties, and it made the finished cigar much more competitive to sell in the American market.
By 1876, more than 2,000 employees were rolling 62 million cigars a year. That made Key West rich, and it made Key West Cuban. By the middle of the 1880s, a third of the island's population was born in Cuba. It didn't take long before they were winning political office. In 1876, Key West elected a Cuban-born mayor. Cubans represented Key West in Tallahassee and served as Justice of the Peace and County Judge. Alejandro Pascual says Cubans kept their cultural identity, and for the most part, locals welcomed them, maybe because they brought their own jobs with them.
It's not that they came and they took away the job from the wreckers or from the spongers. And the city probably smelled great. I ever think of that.
The cigar makers funded groups that wanted to overthrow Spanish rule, giving money to patriotic heroes like Jose Martí. In 1898, the USS Maine left Key West on its way to Cuba, then exploded in Havana Harbor. And that's the event that launched the Spanish-American War, which finally drove Spain out of Cuba. After that, many Cubans left Key West and went back home. But people still crossed the Florida Straits in both directions all the time. For one thing, even though a lot of cigar factories had moved to Tampa by then, there was still an industry in Key West. And for another, as Key West City Commissioner Tony Yanis points out, Key West was isolated from the rest of Florida. The only way to get off the island was by boat.
You know, it was much easier to travel 90 miles through deep, safe water than it was to traverse the very dangerous shoals between here and Miami. And again, there was not much in Miami back in those days.
The new Cuban government was friendly to Key West. When a hurricane destroyed the San Carlos Institute in 1919, Cuba gave $80,000 and sent their best architect to design a replacement.
He designed the San Carlos as a great casona cubana, a great Cuban mansion.
Rafael Peñalver says the building has all the elements of classical Cuban architecture, just like you'd see in Havana.
The high ceilings, the massive wooden doors, the Spanish mosaics that decorate the walls of the San Carlos, the black and white Cuban tiles, handmade.
The building on Duval Street technically still belongs to the Republic of Cuba. It used to be the Cuban consulate. Now it's a cultural center. The cigar industry was finally killed off by the rise of cigarettes after World War I and then the Great Depression. Maggie Hernandez's grandfather was a cigar maker. She grew up in Key West and remembers hearing the numbers for the Bolita, the Cuban lottery, announced over the radio.
If you went down the street, you could hear the radios going in people's houses. Nobody had air conditioning, so all the windows were open. You could hear, 100 pesos, you know, the Bolita.
Key Westers had their own Bolita, using the numbers called from Cuba. One time, Hernandez's father won $1,000.
Back in those days, that was money.
In the 50s, Hernandez worked for AeroVSQ. The airline ran 5 flights a day between Key West and Havana. She announced the 45-minute flights in English and Spanish. Key West wasn't much of a city then. Havana was the big city. They had better shopping, better nightlife, more doctors, so people went there all the time, just to run errands and hang out. Key West was still a Navy town, but some tourists would come to the island and fish during the week.
And then on the weekend, fly to Havana, have a great time. There were a lot of casinos there. I mean, Cuba didn't really envy anything of the United States because it had everything, everything.
For Maggie Hernandez, Key West is less Cuban today than it was when she was growing up here. But Café con Leche is still the fuel that powers the island. Alejandro Pascual retired here less than 10 years ago, after living all over the U.S. and Latin America. He says he can feel the Cuban roots in Key West, even when he meets someone whose last name is Smith.
And then you start talking and say, oh, no, my grandmother's name is Maria Rosa, and she's Cuban. There's a lot of people that you don't realize have Cuban blood.
Some of them speak Spanish, and some don't.
But they all like black beans. They all eat black beans at home.
Pascual says here, he feels Cuban and American. Key West, after all, is midway between Cuba and Miami. It may be physically connected now to the rest of Florida by the Overseas Highway. But geographically, at least, it's always going to be closer to Havana. I'm Nancy Klinginer in Key West.
Later this week on the radio and online at WLRN.org, we will have expanded reporting on the history between Cuba and Key West. And throughout the following weeks and months here on WLRN, we'll continue reporting on the people, the politics, and the policies between America and Cuba. After all, this is a historic moment between the two countries and for South Florida. The movement toward normalizing relations with Cuba has been more than 50 years in the making. What happens now will provide a good view into the future between the two countries and quite possibly the future of this community. Lorenzo Ponce de Leon is our technical engineer. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.